Marriott Bonvoy is the official hotel partner of US soccer. Join Marriott Bonvoy today to get closer to the game with exclusive perks, unforgettable experiences, and benefits that go beyond the pitch. Spring Hill Suites, part of Marriott Bonvoy, offers complimentary hot breakfast and spacious all-suite accommodations, perfect for the whole team, with room for up to 6 guests. Make your next getaway a win. Learn more at springhillsuites.marriott.com.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Hello, everybody. It's John Pollock, and waiting. Has the world ended?
It's over.
It's done. Another year. Another end of the world.
Yes. Always ends with, a new world champion. And we got one.
You're right. You're right. The world's championship reign has ended.
Yes, it has. Mm-hmm. Several reigns.
We have a new champion, and we have an ununified champion as well.
Oh, that's right. Yes, maybe the biggest news coming out of tonight's show.
New belts.
The legs have split.
Yeah. Okay. How are you doing?
I'm good, man. I'm good.
Yeah.
How about yourself?
I'm just checking in on you. I'm making sure you're okay. This is going to be a lengthy one for you. You seem chipper.
Yeah, I'm great. Thank you. Yeah, you do too.
Okay.
All right. You seem like in a good festive mood.
Not so much festive, but in a good mood. Yes.
In a good mood. That's good, man.
I'm having some shoveling today. Did very basic Saturday overall.
That's nice.
And then I just spent my whole evening here in my dungeon downstairs.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right. Way wants to move on to this show, and that's where we are heading, everyone. Hoffman Estates, Illinois.
We could do a full hour-by-hour breakdown of our days if you really want.
No, we could. I think we'd lose most people.
Yeah, some would love it, I feel.
Someone would not. It was our one highlight from the day before we go on.
I don't know. Not really.
You're supposed to say this right now.
Oh, of course. Yes, we'll see.
We're here to talk about the AEW pay-per-view that we had. Mm-hmm. From the Now Arena, just outside of Chicago, but for all geographic purposes, this is Chicago. 8,966, the last number from WrestleTix. And we had the 0 hour, no tailgate brawl this time. This was just the 0 hour. So they didn't have to produce two shows going head to head with one another for this pay-per-view. So that was nice. And on the pre-show, one of the first faces we got to see via his video stream was one Adam Cole, who previewed the final four of the Continental Classic, stating that he hopes to see a lot more of people in 2026. Now, I don't know how much we read into this, but is this Adam Cole shifting careers?
I mean, I kind of feel that way, or at least got that sense from seeing this. I mean, he's kind of been known to have a pretty healthy Twitch life anyway, so it kind of feels like a bit of a natural thing. I mean, I don't know if it would be stuff like this, you know, where he would pop in on the 0 hour to get predictions or something more than that. But I can imagine some sort of transition to a broadcast career. Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe we'll get him in person in the future. Don't know how much the stream really comes across as a personal, but he's got a, you know, sponsored segment here. So that's helpful. Two-Hearted IPA.
I love how, like, even in giving his, like, kayfabe predictions, he still, like, talks as if he's cutting a promo. He still does the, and like, you know, he does that whole thing.
It's a different way of delivering. Like, there's some people who are very good promos that have not transitioned that well to being great broadcasters as a result. This was, promo voice. I didn't pay ultra close attention. Did he actually give predictions? Like, yeah. He did. Okay. I was half listening to this. I thought he was just kind of saying stuff about people. Who did he
chose
predict to win?
Takeshita and did he choose? Oh man, I forget at this point. Maybe he chose Okada and Fletcher. I don't remember. It was a long time ago.
All right. Well, went with Takeshita, huh? So he's not exactly going to be. I don't know. Maybe he won't be Mr. Predictions on these shows.
I don't know how often these predictions pan out for professional wrestling broadcasts.
They don't
including
have a great,
ours.
A great record. Actually, I think we did pretty well on our preview.
Not the Continental
no,
Classic.
No, not the Continental Final. Classic. We did have the final correct, but the incorrect winner. Yes.
Yep.
So let's zip through the 0 hour. Just four matches thrown together. We had the Sisters of Sin defeating Hyun and My World. And nothing wrong with the match. It was very quick, 6 minutes, 10 seconds. Blue hit a very nice looking Code Blue, but she hits it to Maya World, and she is not the legal woman. Hyun is, and as they realize this, they hit double super kicks and then an assisted Uranagi as Sky Blue gets the pinfall. The notable news from this match is that afterward, Tony Khan announcing that Maya World and Hyun are now all elite.
Yeah.
They have won themselves a job.
That they have. Whatever that means these days, I mean, a lot of people get All Elite graphics, and I don't know if it necessarily amounts to any sort of regular presence. It just means that, they might be getting some sort of steady paycheck. It doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be constantly booked. But good for them,
It shows you that 3-minute matches can lead to something, and that can double to a 6-minute match on a 0 hour, and then you get a contract out of it.
I would also suggest maybe something with a Ring of Honor, and who knows, maybe a Collision match, maybe a win at some point for these two.
God forbid we've introduced a women's tag division that includes matches that happen outside of just title matches. I mean, that is kind of the whole purpose of a division being added, is that you have more than just your challengers for the month.
No doubt. But, airtime, especially with the women, is always going to be in extremely limited supply on either of the broadcast shows. So, the match I thought was a perfectly fine opener, honestly. Sky Blue, to me, got some of the only reaction, unfortunately, in this one. I don't know if it was just because of a sparser crowd or just the fact that, people didn't see this one.
They were in Chicago, too. So that's...
Yep. Great looking Code Blue towards the end. I thought it was a pretty tough role for the babyfaces, especially considering Sky Blue's hometown presence, right? So this wasn't necessarily the greatest glimpse of Hyun in My World. So I hope that we'll get to see something actually substantial with them.
They need something more identifiable. Maybe Jeff Jarrett takes them under their wing and he gives My World a theme song.
I feel like he might be looking for something to do. Other than being on the pre-show panel, so maybe
this is Jeff Jarrett's gig. He's he's the hype man. Mm-hmm. Zach Gibson of the Grizzled Young Vets and Eddie Kingston. Kingston got a promo on the way to the ring, but was interrupted by Eddie Kingston. I cannot watch Eddie Kingston's entrance anymore without thinking of the spot with RJ City producing it, saying the rosary and stopping. It's. So he knocks James Drake out of the ring, match begins, and then Gibson ends up hitting a dive as Kingston is dealing with Drake, and Gibson gets in some chops, hits a MX, and James Drake is choking him with the scarf, the dreaded scarf, and we get slaps back and forth. Kingston just fires off some rounds and hits him with a DDT. So he has levels, okay? Are you going to fall to the Hurricane or are you going to fall to the DDT? And this was a DDT Eddie Kingston win in 540. And then Drake still has his goddamn scarf that he's choking him with and outruns Ortiz.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He's back and he got the murder ball. So after all this time, he is
the mad ball.
The mad ball. I think it's been called the murder ball.
Whatever you want to call it, you could die from getting hit by this, but very good to see Ortiz. This was something that I don't know if anybody anticipated, because I don't know if anybody.
I don't think
really
anybody
asking.
Was thinking about Ortiz going into World's End.
I had just assumed this guy was gone. I assumed that he was just done with AEW.
He's done. So. He did a dark match recently at a TV. He's been but if you look at this guy's cage match. Like his AEW proper, like a televised AEW match, like Yeah. We're talking almost 2 years. Like, his last 2 years have just been...
What has he been doing?
He's been hurt. He was hurt for a long period of time. He's been doing independence. Right, so not doing a whole lot in AEW. That's not what he has been
Hook
doing.
Hook beat him at the ROH tapings
last weekend.
And then other than that, like, he's been wrestling on indies beyond...
When was his last AEW match itself? I think it was like early 2024.
January 2024, Blackpool Combat Club versus Eddie Kingston and Ortiz.
So we're talking almost 2 years, dude. At least we have continuity. He will probably be teaming with Eddie Kingston in his next AEW match.
Yeah, he's been like, he was injured, but he came back in March of 2025 just to work outside of AEW throughout the whole year. But, I'm happy to see him back, honestly. Like, coming off of the Proud and Powerful breakup, I mean, there's so much more I think they could have done for the breakup itself, but look at you the height Santana has reached. You would hope similar for Ortiz this time.
I'm sure he wants the call, but do you want that call when you're being told, hey, it's time to come back. You're working on New Year's Eve. Okay, I'll be there in Omaha.
You mean, wait, you're talking about Ortiz?
Yeah.
Like next week? Okay.
I assume he'll be on TV this week, you would think.
I mean, I'm sure he's grateful to have the role at this point. Yeah.
Mark Davis and Rocky Romero taking on Máscara, Dorada, and Bandido. What an awesome team Dorada and Bandido were for 7.5 minutes. Dorada's lucha work. This crowd was just in love with this as Romero played a great bass. Dorado got caught by both, so Bandido came off the top with a tornillo dive. We get an X knee to Romero, shooting star by Dorada. Bandido sends Davis over the top, and then it finishes with the 21-plex to Rocky Romero. 7.5 minutes. Very fun tag match involving Dorada and Bandido, and good opponents for them as well. This is everything I want out of a zero-hour match. I don't need story. I don't need consequences. Just give me a fun match that doesn't overstay its welcome, and I thoroughly enjoyed this.
Fun little showcase, especially for Bandido, who has something big coming up with the title challenge, of course.
Yes. Yes, we will get to more of that. And then, wait, did you have a problem with your feed at this point? Because Excalibur had to apologize for this. We got a video interruption, and my screen, Triller, must be having some financial issues. It read El Clone, and Excalibur apologized for that technical interruption, as this also promoted Coming to Collision in January. This was our technical issue.
Right. Yeah. Well, you got to promote.
This ad that creeped in. And then to close off 0 hour, Jet Speed and Jurassic Express against The Demand and Josh Alexander. So Don Callis is backstage and tells them to take out the dinosaur, clip his nuts. And so that is what they did, minus the clipping of the nuts. But they attack Jack Perry and Luchasaurus as they make their entrance. And then Khan and Toa remove Luchasaurus from the arena. They put him in the back and they just come back.
They clipped his nuts.
Where did they put him? Did they put him in a cage? Did they lock him somewhere? Did they just put him backstage and say, we're going back to the match? What did they think was going to happen?
I have no idea.
This was not a great plan.
Well, they delayed him for most of the match, at least. Well,
anyway, shocking. He would come back, but we had a bit of a handicap match for the beginning because Jack Perry was just laid out on the floor. And so it's 4-on-2. Ricochet shoves Mike Bailey off the buckle, and dude, Bailey just crashed on this apron. This was like the 12th most dangerous thing on the show. Perry finally makes it onto the apron. He's tagged in, and as Ricochet sets up for the spirit gun, who's back? It's Luchasaurus, who in this time has also gotten like a reconstructive shoulder surgery and is all bandaged up. Tags in, one arm choke slam, knee strike by Jack Perry, and Perry pins Ricochet, thus setting up a national title match for New Year's Eve on Wednesday. And that closed the 0 hour. And because this was not, I imagine this not being on TNT, they did not feel the need to do the bleed over into the pay-per-view.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Bryan Danielson came out at the end for commentary, and that takes us into the pay-per-view with Konosuke Takeshita, Kazuchika Okada, semifinal of the Continental Classic. So we're starting off with the semifinal matches. A big AEW chant at the beginning. Everyone was psyched when the bell rung for this match. And early on, Okada's playing it clean, making breaks, and is then trying to get under the skin of Takeshita. And Takeshita becomes the babyface to the crowd, hits a Tope Kanhiro, and then Okada hits a elbow off the top, puts the middle finger right into Takeshita's face, and we get a series of tombstone reversals ending with the Bastard Driver and German. Okada fires back, Emerald Flosion, then is met with a Blue Thunder Bomb, and both men are down. Okada hits his drop kick, tries for the Rainmaker, it's turned into a Poison Rana, and then the Power Drive knee for the first big near fall of the match. The crowd is really getting into this at this point, and then Okada goes to the corner, and he finds the dreaded screwdriver hidden in the turnbuckle, and he turns around, and Paul Turner is just taking this all in. Okada puts this over like he's auditioning for Child's Play and runs at Takeshita with the screwdriver, missing him. Then he takes the screwdriver again, and now Paul Turner, he just has to turn around and like be distracted by, hey, where did these ropes come from? Are these ropes okay? He looked like the biggest putz here because he had to distract himself as Okada stabbed him with the screwdriver and pinned him in 17 minutes and 25 seconds and then placed the screwdriver underneath the ring, which, folks, there would be a payoff to the placement of this screwdriver. I understand that sometimes we have to have our outs for our matches and whatnot. This was such a stupid finish. We have to come up with a creative way because Paul Turner's right here. He couldn't have looked more stupid for these final 20 seconds of the match. It really brought this one down because this was shaping up to be a very good match. I really hated this finish.
I actually thought, in design, I thought it was clever in that a screwdriver hidden in the turnbuckle allowed for interference without actually having interference because this is the Continental Classic. And it also gave you the strong suggestion that you were, you know, Don Callis was involved here. This was Don Callis showing his preference for Kazuchika Okada by placing this weapon that only he knew of here. So I thought like that was good while also still giving a bit of like deniability to keep the story going if they wanted to, because, you know, maybe you could just have Callis say, hey, like I forgot to tell you or something like that, whatever. But the Paul Turner portion of it, he was just in a really bad position.
It was
for
brutal.
For the spot itself, in full view of the first screwdriver attack. I think they really should have done either a ref bump or, as we saw maybe in a later match, just something that looked a little bit more convincing to actually distract his attention away from everything that was in full view here. I don't know what happened. Maybe they did plan for something like that and it just wasn't executed. But
the interference spot now is you bring in a weapon for the ref to take and thus is turning their back, and then you get the real weapon. And that spot gets overdone to death as well. But if you were so dead set on this finish, again, fine, use the screwdriver. But man, did this look so silly at the end of it. And if I'm in the nitpicking mood, which I don't believe this is nitpicking what I've just ranted about, I in theory, the idea that Kyle Fletcher goes for the turnbuckle and the screwdriver is not there, clever enough. If there's one match this dude should he not be watching this match? He's got to face the winner.
Renee mentioned
what did she say?
Watching. She, during the pre-entrance interview, she said Kyle was so obsessed watching Moxley's Continental Classic matches that he didn't watch this match. So they addressed that.
What?
Yeah, she said this during Kyle's entrance.
He's so obsessed with watching Moxley's matches.
He was studying his matches before facing him.
Okay.
That's perfectly plausible.
As opposed to, I'm going to be facing the winner of this match?
Well, if you're about to face
the
guy,
they explained it. I missed the Renee thing. At least they explained this, but
yeah.
You've got to face this guy. You're just going to go blind into this final, then.
Well, you have to get past Jon Moxley first. He doesn't know he's going to. He has, you know, the rest of the show to catch up.
What are you going to learn in these 20 minutes from Jon Moxley?
So you're criticizing the lack of detail, which they actually did address.
Well, I'm just saying, Wei, in the grand scheme of things, you'd be scouting this match that you've got to face the winner of.
I don't know.
Okay, Wei.
Come on, what are we talking about here? I thought it was a great close to, I think, what felt like a very good first chapter between these two. very good counter sequences. As a heel, I thought Okada was excellent throughout. And I thought the match was like satisfying enough, but still conservative in that it kind of kept you wanting to see another.
It was definitely a first match. Yes.
Yeah. Not to mention the fact that Okada would have to wrestle a second match, you know, later on this evening. But like in that respect, I thought all of this was executed like really well, save for, you know, the I would say poor positioning of the referee for that spot.
Marriott Bonvoy is the official hotel partner of US Soccer. Join Marriott Bonvoy today to get closer to the game with exclusive perks, unforgettable experiences, and benefits that go beyond the pitch. Spring Hill Suites, part of Marriott Bonvoy, offers complimentary hot breakfast and spacious all-suite accommodations, perfect for the whole team, with room for up to 6 guests. Make your next getaway a win. Learn more at springhillsuites.marriott.com.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Hey, hockey fans! Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at usahockeyntdp.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.
So Fletcher and John Moxley, all that preparation, how was Kyle Fletcher going to, now it was time for the final exam. And Danielson remarks, of course, what a great body slam that Kyle Fletcher has. And Fletcher traps the leg of Moxley into the steps, and this would be the story of the night. It's really been throughout the tournament of going after Moxley and his ankle and thus leg. And so Danielson thinks that Kyle is training with Josh Barnett for the intricacies of the ankle lock.
Mm-hmm.
So we should have had the
Josh, Josh Alexander, not Barnett.
Oh, I could have sworn they said Josh Barnett here. Okay. Alexander makes a lot more sense here. So he weakens the body part. Moxley hits a dive to the floor, and Moxley is fighting back. He's mounting a comeback, full like babyface here in his defense. And Fletcher hits a big brainbuster, and Moxley's eyes like roll back on the floor. He beats the count into the last ride powerbomb and then to a single leg crab, and he wrenches back so far that he gets caught into a bulldog choke, and then Kyle twists the ankle, gets back to the ankle lock, and Moxley furiously makes it to the rope. And you had a lot of drama here. I think you're going to always have this now with these submissions with Moxley. And then Moxley hits a sleeper suplex off the turnbuckle, and this landing by Kyle Fletcher, this might have been the most dangerous thing on the show. I do have candidates that could top this later, all on their head. This was nuts, dude. And the replay did not ease my concerns here, because this guy looked like he nearly landed like right on the crown of his head coming down.
It was incredibly scary. One of several spots on the show.
Oh, look at his neck folding here. Oh, holy man. Christ.
I mean, these are very young guys who have a lot of flexibility, sure. But, man.
This stuff adds up, man. Like, this stuff, yeah. There is compound interest that is being paid that will eventually come due on some of these spots.
Ask Will Ospreay right now. Listen, I don't want to be the one here to, like, you know, be like, yeah, you young guys, you shouldn't do all this stuff. You know, it's not my body. They are wrestlers. I'm not. They know all this stuff. But I'll just say, like, this wasn't even a spot in the match that I think made that big of a difference to the overall quality of the match. You know what I mean? Like, if you take the spot out, I think we'd still be raving about it all, right?
So, I mean, that's the case for a lot of these spots. Danielson was screaming, I don't think we need a referee. I think we need a doctor. And there's sometimes when Danielson, you feel like, is this just himself just literally calling for something? There's a stomp by Moxley, and then Moxley, Kyle is back to his feet, lands a big knee strike and a brain buster, but Moxley kicks out, gives a middle finger, and then gets dropped. And Fletcher goes to look for the screwdriver. It's not there, and he gets hit by a paradigm shift. kicks out. Hit by a Death Rider, kicks out. And then the choke is applied, and Kyle is fighting it and fighting it. He goes to his knees, and the arms go limp, and the referee calls it off at 22 minutes and 35 seconds as Jon Moxley advances, and not before Kyle gives him a chop block to the knee, and Danielson calls this reprehensible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this match was amazing. Definitely for me, the match of the night. And I could see some people thinking it was the match of the tournament. Maybe certainly one of the latest match of the year contenders we'll probably see this year. I thought as a completion of the Jon Moxley babyface turn, this felt like the type of match you could put on a collection with Austin Brett at WrestleMania, and it wouldn't feel out of place. And that is, to me, like about as high of a compliment I can give any match. Mox was great in this match, as he's been great this entire tournament. But, you know, for this match to be this great, it really required Moxley to put that investment in since that Darby Allin loss, throughout the Kyle O'Reilly feud leading up to this particular moment. I mean, this ankle injury has just been like, it's been a wonderfully told story that has led up to this particular point. And all of these have just kind of resulted in just growing babyface appeal for Jon Moxley to the point now where he was successfully positioned as the underdog heading into this match in the final four. And in this match against somebody like a Kyle Fletcher, who plays that sort of like dominating beat, like, you know, Goliath type of character so well against like somebody who with a weak ankle like a Jon Moxley. I mean both were excellent, but Kyle Fletcher in particular, I don't know where this guy found his power from. You know, this was like the speedy skinny guy in Aussie Open, and now he's one of the most like powerful, like look striking, you know, and just like performing wrestlers in this entire division, and just played a monster here really well. So very scary rest with that suplex. I wouldn't say it was necessary, but was it spectacular? Yes. And maybe they would claim that for that reason it was perfectly necessary. I thought the screwdriver spot was actually also very well done here. It directly ties, number one, to what Renee said, but you know, prior to the match. And it also tells us that Callis is not just favoring Okada over Fletcher, Okada over Takeshita, but maybe he's favoring Okada over Fletcher as well, because you would have thought that maybe there would have been some communication between Callis and Fletcher. But they also did mention that like Callis wasn't ringside, so maybe they're suggesting he was diffusing maybe the tension between Takeshita and Okada. Maybe Callis didn't have a chance to tell Fletcher as a result, so I guess there's still some deniability there too.
It's a good like piece of story to come out of this, and obviously done for a specific reason. And yeah, I agree with you. This was the match of the show for me, and like I feel Kyle Fletcher was the MVP of this tournament, which had a lot of people that you could look at that had some really great tournaments, but to me Kyle Fletcher was a cut above everyone in this year's tournament. FTR and the Bang Bang Gang, Chicago Street Fight for the tag titles. So we had a brawl all over the ring. There was a trash can placed over Austin's head, smashed by a kendo stick. And Dax makes Juice Robinson bleed, juiced. And Austin had this garbage can contraption strapped to his back like a backpack. And he was
like a Ninja Turtle.
Yeah, kind of was very creative here in his overalls, too.
Yeah.
Quite the look.
Well, it's a street fight.
Overall, street fight. Yeah, I got it. What a connection. They attack Juice's knee with the chair and beat on that. There's a fire extinguisher that is brought out, and Juice would have to use that to escape. Tony Schiavone thought that this fire extinguisher spot was like the most clever thing in the world. He was just on cloud nine, like, this is wonderful, was what he said. Cash hits his crazy tope suicida that he does every time. I think this man is trying to break his neck, and one of these dives eventually will do it for him. Crashes through a table over top of Austin.
He does it with the velocity of like a Darby Allin, but like he's a bit heavier. I don't want to be mean and say way heavier, but he's much larger than Darby Allin, so he just like crashes. Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah. You might have thought that would be the bump of the match, but Stokely was he was ready to one-up everyone here. So Juice hits the juices loose on Dax, and Stokely tries to attack Paul Turner. This was not Paul Turner's fault, but this did not look smooth, this save by Stokely. And Dax and Cash proceed with chair shots, and then Stokely is on the apron, stops Juice from using a chair, and Juice sends him off the apron where he is to crash through the table. Dude, this guy was like slip and slide. He slid right across this table, and there was this table was in no danger from this man. Not at all. This was a perfectly usable table after this spot.
Yeah, I'll say, like, so, you know, the spot with Cash, with that Tope Suicida to Austin, that was rather unfortunate too, because he didn't really, like, Austin didn't really make contact with him. And Austin was supposed to be out for, like, several minutes after this. So he just, like, looked like he grazed him and then was out for whatever reason for, like, the next 4 minutes.
Because he pretty much overshot Austin. It was Cash versus a table, and then Stokely just sliding over this one leads to a shatter machine on Juice, and Austin is in to make the save. There's a pile driver on a trash can on Austin. Then they hit him with a spike pile driver, and then a spike pile driver onto a belt, and that keeps Austin down in 17 minutes as FTR retain.
Yeah, I thought the match went a little bit long, if I have to be honest, you know. But for what it was, I mean, yes, very entertaining. I like the match placement here, using the sort of in-crowd weapons brawl as the counter to, like, the ring-confined, straightforward wrestling drama of the Continental Classic matches, I thought was a good call. Resulted in, like, what was ultimately a satisfying brawl with some good hometown babyface spotlight for Juice. Couple of messy table spots, a shatter machine that was mistimed, but otherwise a little bit long, but I thought it was still, like, a good, satisfying street fight by the end.
It didn't get to the heated level that I thought this one was capable of getting to, like that high level FTR tag title type of match, but it was, I wouldn't disagree with any of your notes. Like it was a good match, but certainly not like show stealing or anything at that level, and probably some injured bodies coming out of this one. Babes of Wrath against Mercedes Moné and Athena for the women's tag titles. It was a night of crazy topes, because Athena just like plunged here onto Willow on the floor. Then Willow spears Athena while she's holding on to Harley Cameron. They get the heat on Cameron for a while. There was this totally wacky looking DDT that Cameron countered to hit Athena with. And it's Athena who comes in with Willow. They had a great sequence together here. All these multiple counters, and it ends with Willow getting her onto her shoulders and then tries to spin her onto her knees, nearly lost her in the process, and then hits the pounce. Harley comes in, and we got the Phantom Sling Blade here. This was, like, I think her fingernail made contact here on this Sling Blade. Harley had some rough moments in the first half of this match, but I did think this one really got going for the second half, and the crowd got into it. We had Athena catapulted and lands in a stunner. There's a statement maker onto Willow, but she gets to her feet with a DVD, and then Athena lifts up Moné into a gory special, dropping her on top of Willow. The save gets made. There's a moneymaker hit to Harley, and then Moné stops the babe with the power bomb. And as she goes for her finish, Willow rolls her into a cradle, trapping the leg and pinning Mercedes in 13 minutes and 10 seconds. Athena was furious after, yelling at Mercedes. So coming out of this, we will get Mercedes and Willow on TV this week for the TBS title, and it would seem like we are moving towards Mercedes and Athena coming out of this. But this match had some problems, but the audience did get into it, I would say, for the final couple of minutes, and they seemed to all be on the same page by that point.
Yeah, they were a little bit quieter for this one compared to the rest. I don't really have an explanation as to why, you know, but I thought overall the action was engaging, if maybe at parts a little bit sloppy by like the standards of AEW. So maybe the finish only surprised me in that, like, you had this team beat Moné and Athena twice, you know, two people who really never ever get pinned, but as a tag team, clearly maybe that's the problem, is whenever they're teaming with each other. So they are trying to make a good go out of establishing the Babes of Wrath as champions. And so you have to admire that booking, especially with the way that they're branching off into TV's title match and then maybe an Athena Mercedes feud afterwards.
Yeah, I don't think it's continuing at all, but I think Mercedes and Athena would make for a really great team, like, to establish these belts. I mean, they're obviously going with Willow and Harley, and it's fine. But yeah, it's I'm not crazy about like the losing streak gimmick for Mercedes. It almost feels like it's a reactionary measure to how they've been booking her. And I don't think it's effective. Like, I think it's sort of, you've built all this up, and I would not be trivializing losses for Mercedes and just doing this constant beating of her that they seem to be doing at the moment.
Yeah. The question continues to remain of like how she will lose some of these other belts. I mean, with the TBS championship, you could just, like, if it's easy, she'll drop it to somebody on the roster. But is she going to drop any of these other ones?
She puts all of them on the line with Athena, and then Athena has to go to all these indies and drop them.
Right. Okay.
That's how you get out of
it. At that point, you're just really like giving your luggage to somebody else for them to take. Right.
Next up was the sleeper success of the night. The mixed nuts mayhem.
No, not Darby and Kidd.
Oh, sorry. I already skipped past us. Let's not overlook Gabe Kidd and Darby Allin. We have Darby's latest production. He had some time off, a black and white special. You correct me if I have any of these details wrong. I believe we had a dead rabbit that was, slowly coming to life, or just its carcass?
No, it was quite the opposite. I believe this was like a time lapse of a decaying rabbit.
Okay. Yeah. I didn't know if we were watching it like come back to life, like Darby is been brought back to life.
I don't think so. Yeah, I did not appreciate being shown this.
A dead rabbit.
I didn't need this.
He was also like running through like this ice castle of some sorts. I know this guy was going to be a film student, or he was a film student at one point. I think he took the right career path.
I would say so. Yeah.
Okay. Like, I don't think the world is being, starved from these films.
Everything about these Darby Allin videos like screams pretty bad art school project. But as a wrestler, I mean, they make for really cool intro videos.
Sure.
Don't they?
Yeah, I guess they will. We had a quote in there. I'll remember you as you were, not as what you'll become.
Right. Did he talk about the rabbit? Was this his pet rabbit that died and he decided
If we hear a story like this was his actual pet or something and this was like a tribute for it, aren't we going to feel guilty?
I won't feel guilty. Don't show me you're dying or dead rabbit.
Yeah, I don't want to see it. I can have sympathy if your animal died, but I definitely don't want to see it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. This felt like Roger and Me. Remember that scene?
Of a dead rabbit?
Yeah.
Roger and Me?
Oh, yeah. They like.
I forget. No.
Anyway.
I remember when he wears like orange.
Who, Michael Moore?
Yeah.
Where he wears orange. Or in like, Roger and Me?
Yeah. Like he.
There's a scene in Roger and Me where they like, they kill a rabbit.
Oh, I forget that.
It's pretty
cringy.
Yeah,
that didn't stick with me. When he wears orange because somebody said it would really bring out the color in his face.
It's been a while since I've watched that.
Stands out. Okay.
So they have a big brawl to start. They're just going a million miles an hour. Gabe Kidd like sprinted into the guardrail. There's no way he's doing this kind of a spot with this intensity if he's not like coming in.
Oh, no.
This guy was not saving himself for the Tokyo Dome. Okay. That's what this match was to me. Okay.
We'll compare this performance to the Tokyo Dome. What is it? A four-way tag team match? What is he in? A three-way?
He's in a 5-on-5. Hardcore match, which I don't know if it's going to reach this level.
This was his Tokyo Dome.
This was his Tokyo Dome. Yeah. He ain't doing color next week. He'll let, David Finlay can do all the color in that match. So, man, Darby died about five times during this match. Even like being dumped into the timekeeper's area, he did it with like such a crash that you just felt like something terribly is going wrong. He was catapulted from underneath the steps, busting himself open. And then Darby drop kicks a chair into Gabe Kidd's face. And I guess Gabe Kidd thought, well, fuck my artery. And he just, dude, this guy did, there was so much blood coming from this man's face. And Kidd gets seated on a chair. Darby hits a missile drop kick to the floor. Then a code red off the top. Coffin drop in the ring. Kidd rolls to the floor. So he hits a coffin drop to the floor on top of Kidd. Rolls him in, he kicks out immediately, and as he kicks out, Darby applies the Scorpion Death Drop. This is where we really got Brett and Austin, because he's got him in the Scorpion Death Drop, or Death Lock, as Gabe is literally, like, giving enough blood to, keep a whole ward of a hospital pumping. So he survives. Darby loses his grip. You thought, and they're trying to explain, like, oh, he's dazed. And Kid attacks him. There's a rebound lariat, drill a hole pile driver for a two count, and Kid goes for the sleeper hold when Darby just flips on top of him for the pin in 12 minutes and 50 seconds. Kid lost about 20 pounds in blood in this match, I would argue. And Darby Allin was Tatanka by the end of this.
No, that he was, yes. A very bloody affair. And as I, what is this? His first singles match? Gabe Kidd's first singles match in AEW, right? Proper?
I don't know if this is his first.
Was it not?
First on anyway. Pay-per-view.
Okay, sure, well, whatever. TV, his biggest singles match yet in AEW, yes. All right? And this really, because of the calendar year, feels to me like a proper introduction to Gabe Kidd before he becomes a regular. This is just speculation, of course, but I just... That is a sense I think a lot of people are getting. As a proper introduction to Kidd, I thought he had a tremendous performance. I mean, I thought in this match he was able to convey that he is just as fucking crazy as Darby Allin, and that is a very rare trait, you know? Both of these guys...
I want to see this guy's film project.
Both of these guys just don't seem to know or care about the limits of their own bodies, and that is both scary and exhilarating to watch at the same time. So I think Kidd is already a great fit for AEW, and what AEW audiences look for. He felt like a standout in this match.
I would say during the middle portion of this show, like this stretch of like this match followed by the next match, like there's something to be said for like the art of like the 12 to 13 minute match. And I think that sometimes like not ever like this match, you could have booked this one to go 20 minutes. They more than got their mileage out of 12 minutes and 50 seconds. They maximized it. There was never a dull moment in this match. And I thought the same for this next one that we're going to talk about. Mixed Nuts Mayhem. If ever there needs to be an annual tradition, it's this.
How is there no sponsor for this one?
You know what? That's a great question. Okay, maybe they can get... They'll be lining up after this, okay? You want to get nuts? Let's get nuts.
Let's get nuts. Are we sure, like, what is it? WBD don't own some sort of nut company? Or maybe Paramount would.
Well, they're putting all their nuts on the table right now. That's So it's Mark Briscoe, Orange Cassidy, Roderick Strong, and Timeless Tony Storm against Claudio, Daniel Garcia, Wheeler Yuta, and Marina Shafir. No tags necessary. So we've got a tornado tag. And something that is definitely not overdone in AEW is intergender wrestling. And that was so, like, that was really, like, the novelty of this match. And this crowd ate it up. And they had a lot of unique stuff and seeing interactions that you're pretty much not going to see elsewhere. And it's something that you're pretty much not going to see in any... Well, you get it a little bit in WWE, the odd time, but it's also something that AEW doesn't do a whole lot of, so it made this one unique. We had Cassidy at the beginning doing Daniel Garcia's old dance. Shafir walks up to Cassidy, both put their hands in their pockets, and she just gives him a kick and then gets sent over the top. The Death Riders beat down Roderick, and they're just outnumbering everyone. They control the ring. They beat down Roderick. Then they beat down Briscoe. And Tony then comes in, sending Shafir to the floor, and she starts working with Mark Briscoe. Storm and Cassidy then lock hands for a tango as they mix in dancing with offense. This is the mixed match challenge that we never got.
Yeah, Orange Storm.
Orange Storm. No. Timeless Cassidy. Yes, I like yours better. This just worked really well.
This is great.
The crowd ate up everything here. There's a froggy bow to Claudio. Save gets made. Then Storm hits Germans to Yuta and Garcia, which get huge pops. Then there's a tornado DDT to Claudio by Tony, and Claudio grabs Tony and gives her the giant swing. Then they build up to Roderick and Marina Shafir coming face to face. And dude, Marina Shafir gives them the fucking Anderson Silva to Vitor Belfort front kick right in the right, like upper chest toward the face. So then she turns around and Strong gives her the hardest chop to the back. And They kept it very, very quick between these two. I like this spot quite a bit. There's an orange punch to Garcia, followed by a Storm Zero, then an orange punch to Yuta, a hip attack by Storm, and ends with the J-Driller on Yuta as Mark gets the pin in 12 minutes and 45 seconds. Mina Sharikawa and Luther come out. This was fantastic match. This was so great. This crowd was so hot for this match. And frankly, like, this crowd did not get this loud for, like, the next two matches. Like, they really had to work these next few matches, including the final of the Continental Classic, that, like, from start to finish, this crowd just loved this. And this really worked well. That just last night we talked about this, like, this is just a throwing together eight-person tag.
There certainly is a real novelty to seeing intergender wrestling still to this day, like, on a major platform. And more than that, I think there was, I mean, Toni Storm is incredible. I think Orange Cassidy is incredible.
The characters, like, you couldn't just put anybody in here and just have male and female interactions. Like, it was the characters that made this, and you had, like, a really well-produced match here between these eight.
It was primarily, to me, like, a match that was driven by Toni Storm and Marina Shafir, you know. But, like, I think their interactions can only involve so much, but when you really branch it out to the rest of the roster, including, you know, another AEW original in Orange Cassidy, I mean, this just felt like a fun comic book type of, like, fight scene, you know, where you would say, what if this person fought this person, and this person fought this person, and they were all in a big match together. So, it, like, just the name in itself, Mixed Nuts Mayhem, conveys just an element of fun attached to it, and they completely managed to achieve that. It, to me, was the perfect type of showcase match for a Toni Storm. And, like, you know, intergender wrestling, I think, could understandably still make a lot of people uncomfortable. And I could understand.
Maybe, no one was uncomfortable with this.
No, because I don't think they went too far with it. Like, yeah, you know, I've seen certainly, like, independent wrestling where, like, you can maybe argue, like, something that might work in that setting might not necessarily work, like, on a bigger platform like this. I don't think they ever went too far with any of the intergender stuff. So, it was also a great way to build towards Storm and Shafir, of course, whenever that's supposed to happen.
What about the Mixed Nuts Challenge?
Yeah, I'm down. We got what could we get? Like, pistachio, almonds, cashews, macadamia, even
pecan.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we're moving on from nuts. Lexi Nair is outside Mercedes' locker room. She has a meltdown inside her locker room. Then comes out. She also shattered a mirror. That's bad luck.
Well.
Maybe she's going to be on this losing streak for 7 years.
She might, yeah.
Then she's ready for the interview, disagrees with Lexi Nair that 2025 wasn't a good year for her, and challenges Willow this Wednesday and says, I'm going to beat your fucking ass.
Mm-hmm.
Man, it's like turned into a Limp Bizkit song real quick.
Do you see a title change?
No.
I
say no.
Yeah, why? Because Willow's currently champion?
If they, after all this, and she loses, like, the biggest title on New Year's Eve, which, God bless, only those 1,600 people in Omaha are going to be watching on this Wednesday night, that would be a choice.
Yeah, I don't necessarily see a title change either. I mean, maybe Athena is going to be that person, you know, to take the belt off of her.
Sure.
Yeah.
She should have put up, like, her Winnipeg Pro Wrestling title in this match. That's how New Year's Smash should end.
I don't know if they have that jurisdiction.
Yeah, you're right. They'd have to get a sign off.
But Willow has beaten Mercedes, of course, you know, from their New Japan Strong match.
Yeah. I mean, that was a match where Mercedes ended up getting the injury.
Mm-hmm. If you're the purchasing manager at a manufacturing plant, you know having a trusted partner makes all the difference. That's why, hands down, you count on Grainger for auto reordering. With on-time restocks, your team will have the cut-resistant gloves they need at the start of their shift. And you can end your day knowing they've got safety well in hand. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hello, hello, hello. Davey Portman here from Poison Rana. We cover NXT every Tuesday night on the post-wrestling feed in a show we call Up Next. But we do so much more. Follow Poison Rana Pod on YouTube or wherever you get your podcasts for our live Sunday show. plus our Patreon with movie reviews, retro wrestling reviews, and more. Find out everything at poisonrana.ca.
Chris Statlander, Jamie Hayter for the AEW women's title. I thought they had to really, really work hard for this crowd. And they were coming out to just have a really hard-hitting match. And, man, we had... The crowd was like, it wasn't like they were indifferent, but then they swayed it. We got like chance of like Green Bay sucks, which would also come back later in the show. There was this catapult that sent Jamie Hayter just spiraling into the edge of the steps, and they get into a big striking battle. And then there's an exploder off the turnbuckle by Jamie Hayter. She's selling her lower back. Chris hits a package pile driver, and then they go onto the turnbuckle, and Statlander takes Jamie Hayter into the air for a twisting Michinoku driver off the turnbuckle. And if Kyle's sleeper suplex wasn't the most dangerous thing on the show, this was. Because when I saw this, I thought Jamie Hayter was dead. This was nuts, with no reference to our previous match.
Like another top rope move that just... Oh, man, made me cringe.
This one had no business in this match. This wasn't a near fall. This was like nothing in this match, and it looked very frightening.
Yeah, again, like maybe it wasn't meant to be like such a high angle bump. Maybe, you know, and maybe something went wrong here. I don't know. But like if this was intended, I would just not play with your careers and your lives like that for what is essentially a forgettable spot in the match, you know?
So Hayter gets back to her feet and replies with a Saito suplex, nearly like decapitating Chris. Statlander gets up, spits in Hayter's face, and lands a short arm lariat, tries for the Saturday Night Fever, but it's countered by Hayter. And as Hayter goes for a discus lariat, Chris lands first and ends up hitting the Saturday Night Fever to win in 18 minutes. And 10 seconds. This was an exceptionally physical match that these two had. And it was like, I think in a vacuum, you can really appreciate how hard they worked, but they really had to work for this crowd. And this followed in the match we'll talk next, because I thought Okada and Moxley, like, they really struggled to get this crowd to the levels we had been hearing from this crowd previous.
Right. And again, maybe like this again brings up like the conversation of whether or not these matches are too late when they're on the East Coast or what time zone is Chicago?
I mean, this is the Midwest. So, I mean, they were an hour behind. So they are, right. It's a bit earlier for them. But
well, whatever the case, I think for this particular match, you know, the issues going into it were also just the fact that it's not a feud that's all that hot. You know, like much of the sort of star power in the division is now like swayed towards, well, it was swayed towards the tag team tournament, right? So you're kind of left with Chris Statlander, who's still really struggling to like grab that foothold as a champion who feels like she's actually at the top of the card, and Jamie Hayter, who like hasn't been a huge presence throughout on the show throughout the year. So it was a relatively cold feud heading into it. Their star power is not necessarily the highest, but I thought they worked really hard in the match, took a lot of punishment, and by the end both came out of it to me looking better than before. Like I thought they gained value by throughout the course of the match, and to me,
but like this was like an all Japan women style of match that would have totally fit in that setting. Like that's what they were working with. So I like outside of that Michinoku driver spot, like that was insane. But yeah, you know, everything, like it was a hard hitting, really physical match. I did like this match, but I can see like it was one that, you know, placement wise, would this have benefited a little earlier in the show? It might have, and that's always, you know, you can't tell.
But then I would suggest, like, if you're the champion, you should be able to, like, you know,
yeah,
withstand
that's
this,
fair,
right? And this is the question about Chris Statlander and whether or not she should have been given this sort of like hot shot type of championship run without maybe the proper sort of like audience pent up sort of want for it. you know, she's still in a zone where she's still having to figure things out. I will say, though, towards the end of this match, you know, stuff like with her spitting at Hayter, that was some of the, like, the first glimpses of attitude in Statlander. I saw that actually made me feel like, okay, she's, like, she's actually gaining the confidence, like, deserving, like you know, of, like, a champion, you know, level type of confidence. So I hope she could continue to find that. I mean, I personally would have went with Jamie Hayter because I think Hayter is at a higher level of development than Statlander is currently, but I hope Statlander continues to find it in the weeks to come.
Backstage, we get the promos from Moxley and Okada, and Don Callis is with Okada. He says this is a first-time match. Okada is going to be the first to win back-to-back tournaments. Said, I tried to collaborate with the Death Riders, but now I get my revenge. I've played the long game, and for 3.5 years, I've gone, as he points to the scar. It's like, this guy's had this promo in the back pocket all this time, and says, Okada ends it by just stating, Moxley has accomplished a lot, but you've never beat me, bitch. Don Callis is usually like your goofy, like, comedic style heel. This was just a serious promo from Don Callis, and I thought it was a really great promo. I mean, what else? You carry the scar around for reasons like this.
Oh, great of him to remind us about the scar. And I thought Okada has been sounding really great with his English promos. He's certainly saying a lot more than just bitch these days, and he's sounding really good and expressing a lot of, you know, good attitude with it as well.
And then Moxley, who's got, like, cracked teeth from his last match, and he had to do a lot of talking, both before this match and then at the end of the match. And he's got to just talk through this. He's heard about Okada for years and how he's the greatest. This Continental Classic, he reiterates, is beautiful, and it's a hill worth dying on. And Okada, you're going to have to kill me.
The cracked teeth is crazy. Yeah, we didn't even talk about it during the match itself. But
do you know when it happened in the match?
I don't know, but I imagine it was one of those, like, pretty hard hits from... I mean,
it could have been any, know, Fletcher, like, number of spots.
But... knowing, like, a John Moxley, I feel like he's unlikely to get that
fixed. I thought the same thing. I'm like, he might not fix this because it is a perfect look for him to have.
There's that one point in this match where he started grinning, like, and it really looked great, especially for this, like, babyface version of John Moxley. So
for everything we joked about that tweet when it comes to John Moxley, Gabe Kidd recently, and Shiloh Hill, Taker was right about the toothless aggression beginning.
Oh,
yeah.
Yes, that is right. Yes.
So it was Okada and Moxley in the final of the tournament, and Okada targets the ankle, and boy, did he target it, because he just dominates, like, the first 10 minutes of this match. This was Wei Ting's favorite, slow simmering Okada building heat.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And we got it all in its glory. Okada used, like, a series of dragon screws and then a clover leaf, which Brian did link to Tanahashi. They were not going out of their way to mention this Tanahashi match at all. And I would imagine that continues on Wednesday, which is just weird. Like, this was so clearly designed, like, to be a link with the match next week, that he's taking Tanahashi's weapons.
Yeah. Also, no mention of Takeshita facing Yoda Tsuji. No mention of the name Yoda Tsuji
at
all.
Nothing.
And I understand it's not the story, but it is just kind of odd.
But it is a mention. These are our partners, and next week, you know, it's like whoever comes out of this tournament is.
I feel it's very deliberate, like, because these are commentators that will pick up on really anything. So the fact that, like, they, you know, like, you see a Texas Cloverleaf, you see Dragon Screws, you're mentioning learning a lot from Hiroshi Tanahashi, but not mentioning that he's about to face him in his retirement match, I feel is a very deliberate choice or direction from Tony Khan, you know?
So it's all Okada on offense until finally Moxley catches him with a gotch pile driver, and Okada tries to send Moxley into the referee, and with his back turned in the corner, kicks him low and hits a short arm rainmaker for a two count. Okada goes to get the belt. Stephon Smith takes it away, and then Moxley kicks Okada in the balls. So both men being hit in the testicles. They trade strikes. Moxley pops up from a drop kick. Takes a short arm rainmaker, and then Okada lifts up Moxley, who hits him with the paradigm shift. This is where I know, like, this crowd was really subdued at this point. And then Moxley hits his own Rainmaker, and this seemed to liven things up at this point, because I think they sensed, like, now we're going into the big closing stretch. There's a paradigm shift. Okada kicks out at one. Moxley hits the stomp. Crowd's going loud here, and then a Death Rider to win it in 20 minutes and 10 seconds. And John Moxley wins the Continental Classic. And listen, if this tournament is viewed as the biggest tournament in wrestling in hindsight, a lot of it is going to be based on this guy's celebration afterwards. He treated this like this was the grandest achievement of his entire career. He's like wiping back tears. And then he cuts this promo with, again, man is in need of dental work. And just as the Death Riders are in the ring, he takes the microphone and says, this title doesn't belong to me. It belongs to everyone in this tournament that busted their ass. The fans that support wrestling, we owe it to them to give them everything we have. This is the hardest working pro wrestlers in the world. We'll continue to give it our all, and no other organization in wrestling, I'm talking about you, Juggalo Championship Wrestling, can do what we do. And the best part about this is that as John Moxley is just the most over-the-top babyface, Danielson is never going to break. He's just like, I'm having a hard time taking this man at face value. But then he says, you know, he said from the beginning he wanted to change AEW. Maybe he saw what he wanted to see in this Continental Classic. And if that was a line off the top of Danielson's head, this guy is tremendous. He is just outstanding.
Could be. I have to also think, like, Danielson is keenly aware of, obviously, the direction of the Moxley character. Maybe he even has a hand in its creation, and probably has to think, like, I'm just sitting here, like, a year from the date.
He is, like, now Renee in some ways. Like, he's conflicted. What? Like, he has got got to balance the character of John Moxley with his character with in relation to John Moxley.
Yes, but Renee never had a plastic bag put over her head by the person that she's standing very close to.
No, right? But she had to, like, balance, like, these same things, and that's kind of in a weird way what Danielson has to do now. Like, Danielson should not just be cheerleading John Moxley on commentary.
Of course not. Absolutely not. Again, especially after, like, having a plastic bag put over your head and everything, right? But, like, in the end, he recognizes, well, like, the quality of the John Moxley character. Like, from day one, he very much is like a Thanos in that, like, he thinks of himself as the good guy. And maybe at his heart, like, he just wants what's best for AEW, right? But he's just going about it through the
murdering Danielson is just, you know, you got to crack some eggs, okay?
That's kind of what his justification was at the time, right? You know, you had gone too soft. You forgot the message. You forgot the goal of the Death Riders or Blackpool Combat Club. We're here to change this company. And maybe Mox has finally discovered that.
That is ripe for someone to accuse Moxley of falling for the exact same pitfalls of becoming
exactly
soft.
Exactly. Yes. Well, this is what's so interesting about this result. I didn't see this coming myself. I thought we'd get the turn. I thought we'd be getting the turn after every pay-per-view.
The way this was really setting up, dude, I thought Danielson was going to lead these guys and attack him, and Danielson was going to take over these guys.
But they're dragging this thing out really well. Like, they are just making us think that we're going to get the turn, and then they're just delaying and delaying and delaying. And I thought, even in celebration, somehow, I thought we were going to get the turn simply because you had these four Death Riders here, minus Pac, by the way, who was not present. Who came in smiling.
Where was Gabe Kidd? He was probably getting a transfusion.
Probably, yeah. I don't know if he's officially a Death Rider, but anyway.
He's Death Rider adjacent.
These four came out, like, celebrating, clapping, which is so uncharacteristic. I've never seen the Death Rider celebrate like that. So I'm like, okay, the turn's definitely coming. They held back, but everybody is expecting it and continuing to expect it. And I think they're doing a great job of delaying that gratification from us.
I really was... you know, the match was very good. I thought that,
but the weakest of the three.
Yeah. I didn't think that this was, you know, I was definitely down on the Okada Takeshita finish. This certainly had a better ending to it. But yeah, like, this to me did not come close to Moxley and Fletcher earlier in the show. And I was just surprised that, you know, sometimes on AEW shows you will get dips in the crowd, but this was one I was just surprised. Like, the first half of this, and maybe it was just, you know, this Okada just just beating him down, and it was very slow and plodding. But, you know, it was like, you can't argue like stars or stakes were not part of this. Like, this was the big match of the tournament, and they, like, it was very subdued for, I would say, like, first, like, 70% of the match.
I feel like if you're watching this match, like, if you're watching this Okada match, you're probably expecting the last, like, 5 minutes to be, like, 5 to 10 minutes to be, like,
I think that's part of it, too, is at the beginning, it's like, we know this is going long. We know this is going a significant amount. Like, this went shorter, actually, than I thought. It was, like, 20 minutes. But, man, the post-match was really excellent. And just really puts this tournament over as we spread the legs.
Was it the best Continental Classic, as I've seen some people say?
I feel it was, because I just think every single show we had one match that was pretty close to, if not incredible. Like, I don't feel there was one of these Dynamites or Collisions that didn't give you at least one really excellent tournament match.
Even losing Darby, like, did not hurt, you know?
I think, you know, Jack Perry wasn't the performer of the tournament, but I thought especially these matches he had this week, like, you know, he had some good matches in this tournament. I don't know if it's enough that it's going to propel him any higher, but yeah.
But it continues to show that, like, it continues to be an incredible showcase of the depth of this company.
Yeah.
You know, you pick, like, 12 guys, and you're just...
No Ospreay, amazing. No Omega, like...
Yeah. Amazing.
Swerve, Hangman, MJF, Joe, like, all these guys that you didn't even have in the tournament. Like, imagine if Ospreay had been around would have been in this. So then we go to the main event, which is Samoa Joe, Swerve Strickland, Hangman Page, and MJF for the AEW World Championship. Green Lantern represented here by Swerve.
Yeah, this one might have been my favorite.
It was a nice outfit. I thought. So MJF and Swerve, they took turns swinging their crotches into each other's face. And Swerve, I guess feeling, it felt like this guy had something to prove in this match. Like, since he's come back, you know, the guy's packed on some muscle. And this guy goes out and does a Fosbury flop. I'm like, that's just a statement out there to anyone that is questioning what he can still do. And, you know, he is carrying more weight. You're naturally going to be a bit slower when you're packing on muscle like that. But it did feel like he was, and the broadcasters were even bringing it up. It's like, man, he's added all this weight, but he's still as agile as ever. I don't know how he does it.
A lot of guys seem to be able to do this, right? It's like maybe having that muscle memory attached to it. And then, I don't know. I don't exactly have a great explanation.
Well, I'm hoping you have a better explanation than me, because I didn't have one for this. We have seen Hangman Page deliver the Orihara moonsault, not on a weekly basis, but pretty damn close to it. Like, this is his staple move. This was the worst one he has ever executed. He overshot everybody and might have, like, headbutted MJF coming down. And he looked like he busted his mouth or something, because he was just grabbing his mouth. This was a total mess, this Orihara moonsault that we've taken for granted. He always nails his target perfectly. And this one, I don't know what it was. It was maybe the multiple people, but he just overshot everyone.
Yeah, I honestly, I don't know if it was just like the people being in poor position, or maybe just Hangman just miscalculating the distance. But unfortunately, this resulted in some phantom bumping from the other two. Yeah.
So we have Swerve leaning over, and Hangman flips over for a buckshot using Swerve's back into Joe. The crowd's like, wow, what chemistry. And then it's Swerve and Hangman alone in the ring, just staring at one another, and this crowd erupts. And they get into it. Swerve hits a deadeye onto Hangman, and then Page stops the house call, lands the buckshot, but Joe stops the cover. Page would use a angel's wings onto Swerve, and then it was just a lot of multi-man spots. MJF would apply a salt of the earth to Hangman while Joe put the coquina on. So MJF gave up on the armbar to go rake the eyes of Joe. And there's a coquina clutch applied to MJF, which gets broken by a house call. Now, this was one thing they did. So in the Fletcher match, we did just, you know, he's out. In this one, we're doing the arm has to be raised three times. I think we need some consistency here.
Yeah, I guess so. I guess when it's a choke, I don't know. I don't have a great explanation. Like if, in an MMA fight, if somebody's in a
you're not putting a guy's arm up three times.
No, they'd be brain dead by the time.
To me, the Fletcher finish was awesome. Like I think that's more dramatic. But you know, for doing a submission tease, they still feel the need to do the arms here. I'm just like, you got to pick one. I don't think we can do both anyway. So all four men end up down. Easy chant for the crowd to get on their feet and cheer. Then MJF hits the Panama Sunrise onto Swerve. And there's a dead eye delivered to MJF. The ops run down. And we see a muscle buster onto Paige for a two count. And Joe looks shocked that someone's kicked out of the muscle buster. So that was your tip off that Hangman's not winning this match. This is his big kick out spot. Hook gets onto the apron. He yells at Bryce for a long time. And he just stands on this apron forever. And then finally, Hangman walks over to Hook, and Hobbs and Shibata are going after Nana and get struck with a swerve stomp on the floor. Paige goes after Hook, but he's caught in the coquina as Joe comes from behind. It's broken by a swerve stomp, and Paige rolls out of the ring. Swerve hits a powerbomb off the turnbuckle. The swerve stomp gets stopped when MJF shoves him to the floor, and then Paige tries to take Joe off his feet. He hits two buckshots, and when he goes for the third, MJF pushes Joe out of the way, kicks a field goal between Paige's legs, sends him out, and with Joe staggered, hits him with the heat seeker, and the man who beat MJF for the title at World's End 2 years ago. It's a role reversal. And now MJF pins Joe to win the title at World's End 2025 in 20 minutes and 35 seconds.
Mm-hmm. So I thought it was an entertaining four-way. But like I feel like there's something certainly lost maybe with multi-man matches where I don't know if some of the closer storytelling is something I wish maybe this main event had a little bit more, and maybe it was lost because of the multi-person aspect of it. But in terms of action, it was very, very engaging, very, very like fast-paced and well-coordinated, very good. For me, the combination coming out of it that I'm actually most interested in is MJF and Swerve. And I feel like there's some actually like really strong animosity being built between the two of them through the promos that were exchanged over the past week. And now in some of this dick thrusting interaction between the two of them as well.
He did Swerve's dance as well.
Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm.
And then jacked off on the crowd.
He did do that. Yeah. Motioned for it at least. What did you think?
I like the main event. I agreed with you. Like it felt like a four way that was heavily reliant on, you know, just doing all the different kinds of saves and teases. And listen, the crowd was much more into this than they were the final of the tournament in the match that followed or that preceded it. It feels like Paige and Swerve is, I think, the biggest rematch that they can do sometime next year. And I hope when they're ready to do that, it's a really, really big deal because they've built that up to be like the rivalry of AEW's history. And the way this ended, like I thought it made the most sense here of MJF wins the title. He defends against Bandido and probably steals his ring. I'm still banking on that. And then you can do a bunch of matches out of this. Like you certainly could do, you know, the fact that Hangman beat MJF and now Paige can go for the title here. You can do the match with Swerve. There's a lot you can do with MJF as champion that I don't know if, like, Joe was pretty much like your, you know, he was the vessel to get the belt from Hangman to MJF without giving away the Hangman-MJF rematch.
And he got like a new life, you know, on his career coming out of it as well. I think, you know, to confirm this heel character, I thought the 1 month reign, as short as it was still very effective in that sense. I do wonder if in hindsight though, like if Paige held onto the championship all the way up until this point where he might have lost it, but not even necessarily get pinned. I wonder if that would have like played for a maybe more compelling, you know, heel victory here in MJF. But then you wouldn't necessarily have some of that value with Joe. So I mean, ultimately, I think they got to the point where that they needed to. It'll be interesting to see what happens with Joe after this, though, in the ops. I guess he's still a trios champion, isn't he?
They are still the trios champions.
Okay. Yeah. He's got his own dojo now, which is nice.
Well, they got to find some trios in this company.
And you have this dangling thread, I suppose, with Hook and Paige, which I don't really think is the big, like...
Revolution.
Yeah, I don't know if it's like, you know, like Paige attacking Hook is necessarily like the big thing that, you know, the big carrot that deserves to be dangled as much as it is, but it's something.
December on the Post Wrestling Cafe, we have two editions of Rewind Away set for you, including a patron's pick where you have voted for us to review the Survivor Series from 1991, Hulk Hogan's Gravest Challenge. Then it's over to 2002 and a review of the very first WWE draft involving Raw and SmackDown as they kick off the brand extension. David Bitsenspan is going to join me as we review Video Killed the Radio Star, a documentary on Bubba the Love Sponge, and the sex tape involving Hulk Hogan. Plus, we will have reviews of TNA Final Resolution, New Japan's World Tag League Final, Collision Course every single week, and XL editions of Rewind to Raw, Dynamite, and SmackDown. Sign up now at postwrestlingcafe.com.
How'd you feel about the final AEW show of the year?
So I really love Moxley versus Fletcher, and that alone I feel like certainly makes the show like worth watching, but there were definitely hot peaks and valleys. I thought the quality of everything, the action was really strong. Maybe some of the crowd... was not as strong, and I don't think you necessarily blame the crowd even. Could be, listen, like if this crowd was amazing, then I wouldn't complain about anything, right? So you could point to a number of things. Was it the build? Was it just like, you know, the star power of some of the wrestlers here? There are a million excuses, but ultimately maybe the show to me peaked with like the second match, but the rest of the matches were also very ultimately like satisfying.
Yeah. I mean, we got our like positives and negatives out, but I gotta say, I really enjoyed this show. Like in terms of just pacing, which we sometimes talk about, like to me, this was not an AEW show that dragged. I thought that they generally timed out the matches I thought the last two matches went 20 minutes, and that was like less than I expected those two to go. On top of it, like I just felt like it was a really fast paced show that did not overstay its welcome. It did not feel like a drag at any points. So, and I thought like what was the worst match on the pay-per-view? And it was still like, you know, a very good level. Like mm-hmm. I thought everything was like, you know, the floor was very solid for across the board here. And yeah, you got something like Fletcher Moxley that was just an excellent, excellent match as well. So there you go. That was the end of the world presented by AEW. And let's send it on over to the forum way. And we're going to do some feedback.
Sure, let's go here to Andrew from Cape Breton, who says, another very good show. Lots of use of the word fucking on this show, and there was certainly some fucking good stuff. There weren't any bad matches. Some did have issues with the crowd like Hayter and Statlander, but in the end, they were able to get them into it. I know the specter of CM Punk has long since been exorcised from the company, but tonight seemed to be the final confirmation with a generally positive reaction to Jack Perry for just being Jack Perry and tickets selling well. I thought for a while that AEW killed the town with the Punk issues, but it seems like Chicago is finally back to being a good town for them. What's ironic is despite the excellent wrestling, the match of the night for me was the chaotic Mixed Nuts Mayhem match. The wrestling is usually so excellent that it's become the norm, and having a wacky chaotic match like this tag stood out. I also do like MJF getting the belt the way he did, as they can push the contract match at All In every year and have some sort of precedent that the winner has a likely shot at being the world champion without having to go through the Money in the Bank cash in nonsense. Overall, another excellent outing on pay-per-view.
It's a great point. I didn't even think about the Jack Perry stuff tonight. Like I feel this company has long since moved on from the Punk stuff, but yeah, that is notable that you know, Jack Perry didn't get any kind of different reaction in Chicago, and I think it's like your final note of kind of moving past that particular chapter and all the fallout that the Punk stuff brought AEW.
Before we go on, we have a super chat here from Jake from the Windy City, who sends $11.25. Thank you very much, Jake, for the constant support here. From Chicago, who says, the main event had a big fight feel in the building tonight. I would have loved a Page reclaim, but I think it's Max's time again for a bit. Fletcher and Mox was match of the night. Glad to be at the show live to end 2025.
All right. There's some feedback from the show. Thank you, Jake. All right, we'll continue on with Jay from Colorado. I thought tonight's show hit on almost all levels. I thought the mixed tag was the most fun by far, with the dancing sequence between Orange Cassidy and Toni Storm being the most unforgettable moment. They looked like they were having a lot of fun, which made it fun for everyone watching. I hated that the first Continental Classic semifinal ended with shenanigans, but I'm happy overall with how the Classic ended. MJF's champion again. I'm excited to see him back where he belongs. I stepped out for a moment to tend to my dogs in between matches, and when I came inside, there was a bunny in reverse decomposition on my TV.
Was it reverse? Maybe I'm mistaken then. Maybe it could have been.
I'm not going to give this too much a dissection. Only one or two things it could be, I thought to myself. A Nine Inch Nails video or a Darby Allin entrance. Look, I'm a film theory major, and there are a few people who are into this art house shit more than I am, but I don't want to see a decomposing animal while I watch wrestling. Just a personal preference. I think everyone is probably on that same plane.
Yeah, yeah. It wasn't for me. I mean, I saw a lot of gross things tonight. All right. Let's also go to a super chat from 1UP versus CPU64, who's a member of our YouTube video members channel. He says, then Hater got her back with the Uranage. Okay, so I guess in reference to the head drop, which that Uranage, I don't know if it was necessarily a receipt or not, but yes. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Okay, my turn again.
Yes.
Let's go to Brian in New Jersey, who says, I thought this was a very good pay-per-view and a year full of them from AEW, while also feeling like one of the better paced ones. The standout matches to me were Moxley's two matches, amazingly making him a face. It was good to hear Danielson still express mixed feelings on commentary. I like the main event a lot, with MJF being the overall best choice to win. I thought Statlander and Hayter won over the crowd with the bombs they dropped on one another. Mixed Nuts Mayhem was just plain fun, as intergender wrestling is still thriving on pay-per-view. Only match I wasn't feeling was FTR versus Bang Bang Gang. The Mystery Vortex 0 Hour was highlighted by the prospect of Bandido and Mascara Dorada as a regular tag team, and the announcement online that Hyun and Maya World are all elite.
Yeah, I like the 0 Hour for what it was, of just throwing together some entertaining matches, and you know, all quick but enjoyable. Nicholas writes, for me, the most compelling story going right now continues to be the revitalization of Jon Moxley. Moxley and Fletcher was easily the match of the night, but I think Okada was the perfect final opponent for him as someone who's perfectly confident with who he is and what he is capable of. He's a great contrast against Jon Moxley, who has gotten so complacent with his House of Torture bullshit that the tournament essentially saw him relearning how to fight his own battles, and I think Moxley has been masterful at demonstrating that he really needed to dig deep to find that guy. My only criticism is I think his rallying cry at the end was unearned. He hasn't really had his come to Jesus moment where it makes sense to me that he's lauding literally everyone in AEW's orbit, from fans to wrestlers backstage. I think that just got a bit too ahead of themselves with that. I don't know about that, because it, like, if you've listened to his promos, and a lot of these have been online as well, like throughout the tournament, like this has been like he went into this tournament at this low point of losing to Darby, of getting caught by Kyle O'Reilly, who's just got this guy's number. And you went into this tournament where, like you just outlined yourself, like he did not have any of the Death Riders to back him up in this. He had to face Claudio himself in this tournament, and he comes out of it, and this was like the toughest tournament he's ever been a part of, and he had to find a piece of himself, and realizing that it's a small select athlete that can do this tournament, and I'm in a company with you know, with 10 of these guys that all did this. And I feel like it was kind of like this story that's been going on for quite some time, and I didn't feel it was like too out of the ordinary. And another thing is that after this, I think I'm even more interested in seeing another Moxley Kyle O'Reilly match sometime next year, of like, now this is Jon Moxley who has pushed himself and can, like, it now means something if Moxley can beat Kyle O'Reilly. And that is bonkers to me that we're saying that.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. For me, I felt like the promo by the end, like, it didn't feel unnatural to me, just given like the man has really bottomed out, right? He's reached his lowest point, at least as a competitor, through the Kyle O'Reilly feud, and then through the first portion of this Continental Classic. Like, he was like really low, and that's when you really got the shift in promo style. I feel like that's when he started really kind of like adopting the role of the babyface, and adopting the role of somebody saying, you know, like, I'm still in this, you know, and I'll still fight my hardest, and I'll still kind of like fight my, like, do everything I can, because there's always whatever. Like, So him giving this sort of very emotional speech celebrating all the competitors, like, I could buy that. You know, even somebody who's as big of an asshole as Jon Moxley was, I could buy that, having gone through that sort of like roller coaster, that he would now be grateful for not just himself or not just his win, but really all the other competitors that were also there with him. He did, to me, he did do a bit of a you people deserve this. Like, and that I definitely think maybe kind of borders on like an uncharacteristic thing for Jon Moxley to say. But it wasn't primarily that. He was primarily giving credit to the rest of the C2 competitors. It was just maybe bordering on like being a little bit too much, but I personally didn't think it was. But follow up is also incredibly important, so we'll see how well he does there. My turn here. We go to Sal from California, who says, I watched the pay-per-view with my 8-year-old daughter. I have 3 kids, but she's the most passionate wrestling fan out of them. Here are my daughter's reactions. She was jumping around and doing somersaults on the couch when the Babes of Wrath won. Willow is her favorite. She made me rewind Mercedes freakout moment backstage because it made her laugh so much. I hope you covered her ears for the promo. She can't stand Toni Storm because she's, quote, too old-fashioned and dramatic. Agreed. She was furious every time Toni danced with Orange. Yeah, she is old-fashioned. She was yelling at Toni to leave Orange Cassidy alone. She used to love Swerve, but he's now a heel in her book because he changed his theme song. Ugh. A wrestler's theme song can make or break for an 8-year-old. I think
I might be the only one who actually likes the new theme song more.
I feel a lot of people would agree with your 8-year-old daughter. Those are her big takeaways. Mox versus Fletcher was the match of the night for me. I'll keep it brief since I know it's late for you guys on the East Coast. Have a good night and happy New Year's.
We always appreciate 8-year-old feedback to these shows. It does.
I hope she keeps watching.
Big match for her on Wednesday with Willow and Mercedes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
All right, let's go to the man himself. It's time for Mean Muggin. The match I was looking forward to was Okada Takeshita, and I was into it, but the finish was dreadful, and it took me out of it. Way to make your IWGP World Champion look strong, AEW. Jon Moxley was the MVP of this pay-per-view, as he and Kyle Fletcher surpassed the opener and pinned Okada in the same night to win the C2. I kept waiting for a gut punch from Moxley's crew, but it never came. The 8-person intergender tag was a very enjoyable palate cleanser from the bloodshed of Darby and Gabe. The money train is almost off the rails. 2-title Willow on Wednesday? I need that. Mercedes is one step closer to the edge, and she's about to break. Oh, man. Some Lincoln Park in there from Muggin. He's going wild here after this pay-per-view.
Thank you very much, Muggin. Let's go to AUK. This is, who says, gotta say the booking of Takeshita versus Okada is just infuriating. The suspension of disbelief to think the referee wouldn't see obvious screwdriver strikes is just idiotic. Beyond the idea that this is a good finish in a pure wrestling match. Let's be honest, if this happened in WWE, there would be groans all over.
Okay, we don't have to do the let's be honest, because I think everyone was in compliance on that finish not being the most ideal.
Again, I had no issue with the screwdriver. In fact, I thought it was a bit of a clever way to, continue the feud, first of all, and also to inject Don Callis into it, because you needed to inject Don Callis into it, because it's the Callis family turning on Takeshita. That is the story. And it also, of course, protects Takeshita in a way that gives him, you know, an out that's not a pure loss, because you want to save that for later on.
But you had an oversight that was impossible to... Yes. Like, to me, it really overshadowed the whole finish. Like, to me, you're structuring this. Okay, use the screwdriver, but you have to take into account, like, you have to structure this match around a way to get Paul Turner to, like, that to me overshadowed everything at the end.
Yeah. The Paul Turner stuff was, unfortunately, the mishap. Mm-hmm.
Well, there you go, everybody. We've landed this plane, and that is the end of our AEW World's End review. We thank everyone for checking us out here late on a Saturday night into a Sunday morning. We are here every Monday, every Wednesday, every Friday with reviews of Raw, Dynamite, SmackDown. Consider giving the channel a subscribe, hit the button, and you can join us live if you are a member of the Post Wrestling Cafe after Raw, after Dynamite, after SmackDown, each and every week. And we'll be having plenty coming out this week, including a new book club for our members on the cafe, chatting about The Last Heart Beating by Natty Neidhart.
Excellent.
We will dive into that and much more as we wind down 2026. So back on Monday following Raw, which is a live episode this Monday. So we will have a new Raw to discuss.
Yeah. The New Year is approaching, and that means our Wrestle Kingdom reviews, plural, will be dropping in about a week's time. So subscribe for that. Also, our best and worst of will be coming in the month of January. And of course, if you missed the Christmas show, which you should all be listening to right now, we are about to have a price increase in February. All right. But with the caveat that everybody currently subscribed to the Post Wrestling Cafe or will subscribe throughout the month of January, you can lock in your price for the rest of the year. So we're going from $6 to $8. But if you're subscribed right now or subscribe at some point in January, as long as you stay on for the rest of 2026, you can pay $6 instead of $8 for the rest of the year. Oh, man. I did not play that. John did. I'm not taking responsibility for that.
PostWrestlingCafe.com. Sign up during the month of January. You're locked in. But February 1st, that's when the change occurs. So we went through all of this at the beginning of the Christmas show. We will reiterate it on some of the shows this week. So thanks to everyone for joining us. PostWrestling.com is where you can go. Great coverage all night long by the great Neil Flanagan, having you up to date on everything related to World's End. And we will speak with you Monday night following Raw.
Marriott Bonvoy is the official hotel partner of US Soccer. Join Marriott Bonvoy today to get closer to the game with exclusive perks, unforgettable experiences, and benefits that go beyond the pitch. Spring Hill Suites, part of Marriott Bonvoy, offers complimentary hot breakfast and spacious all-suite accommodations, perfect for the whole team, with room for up to 6 guests. Make your next getaway a win. Learn more at springhillsuites.marriott.com.
Hey, hockey fans! Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at usahockeyntdp.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.